From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Sometimes doctors are thoughtless, tactless, perhaps even a little mean.
She's here, she has painkillers, she just thinks there's something more wrong with her than there is.
And as patients, that hurts.
I just was so stunned, I was speechless.
So where does this story start? Let's presume doctors choose their profession because they want to help others.
Many of us go into medicine with that motivation.
Does that sentiment change?
Something happened in medical school.
Often what we see about a patient first is their blood work, or it's their x-ray, or the disease process that they have.
On today's show, a look at empathy. How does it affect patients? Can you measure it, teach it, grow it? Also, rescuing medical devices from an early grave and a case for banning catcalls. First, the news. You're in pain, you're scared, you're waiting at the emergency room, and finally, the doctor comes to see you.
Meanest face I've ever seen. Sighs and says, now what's going on?
It's The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse connects you to the latest research and tackles your questions about healthcare.
You can think of your genome as a piano.
Being blind from birth, I had to actually learn to think like a sighted person.
Really, the most important thing to make this a success is that the primary care providers have to buy into it.
Always maintain hope.
Fear is woven into the daily existence of medicine.
Neutrinos are some of the fundamental
particles. To see that in the arc of a career is
they literally have to teach them like what a pencil was.
Right, you see the gene gap.
I may get frustrated.
I'm concentrate.
Slow down the rate at which water temperatures are increasing.
On today's show, hey baby, smile. Is street harassment a public health issue? Also, one man's quest to give pacemakers a second life. And nursing advice from the naked mole rat. But first, back to that sighing doctor with the mean face. It brings up an important question. What do we want from our physicians? Skills? Sure. A laser-sharp brain? A steady hand? Absolutely. But we want something else. Kindness. Empathy.
It's really a practice of witnessing and walking beside.
It's different from sympathy, which might involve pity or feeling a patient's suffering. Empathy means acknowledging, understanding the patient's plight. And when physicians exhibit this quality, it affects medical outcomes.
We have shown that patients who are treated by empathic physicians are better off.
Some doctors do this naturally. Others, not so much.
That level of connection is just not part of their skill set.
Can they learn? Can empathy be grown and nurtured? How do you measure empathy? A lot of questions, and we'll get to them. But first, let's hear two stories that set the scene. Andrea Karabetzes lives in New York City. She's a writer. One night she had horrific pelvic pain and strange bumps on her abdomen. She decided to go to the emergency room, and after a long wait, the doctor came in and basically said, "What do you want me to do about it?"
And I said, "I have all this pelvic pain. It's the worst it's ever been. Today, I'm really scared because the painkillers I was given aren't even working, and I'm really scared something's really wrong with me, and I don't know what to do." And she goes, "You have painkillers. Why are you here?" Like I was wasting her time. Like I wasn't scared and using the emergency room as a last resort. So after I started crying and said, "Because I have no other place to go and I'm scared that something's wrong with me, I don't know if something's going to burst or what." And she goes, "Well, let me give you a pelvic exam then." So this mean doctor who snapped at me and asked me why I was wasting her time then gave me a pelvic exam. After which she felt the weird bumps in my abs and said, "Oh, we'll see what we can do."
Karabetzes has since been diagnosed with a pelvic muscle disorder and she is receiving treatment for that. When a doctor lacks empathy, it can make patients feel ashamed, belittled, vulnerable. For Philadelphian Adrian Berger, lack of empathy colored a life-changing moment. She was sitting with her dying mother in a hospital room. Her mother had been taken off life support and it was only a matter of time.
And then the doctor, who was very young, physician, possibly a resident, I don't know, came in he did the checkup, and then he just came to me very devoid of compassion and very mechanical and said, the patient expired at so-and-so time. And it was a very painful moment for me. And it was the kind of situation where if he had just taken a short minute to think of who you're talking about, you know, it's not just a nameless, a faceless patient, but it's a woman who had a life, and her name was Jeanette Berger. And you're sitting across from her daughter, who is Adrienne Berger, who is going through a very painful moment. And just maybe put his hand on my shoulder briefly, or, you know, I'll say I'm sorry, or just a few words. It would have made quite a difference because, you know, this is a moment I'm going to remember for the rest of my life.
Berger says for the doctor, it was just a tiny moment during his shift. Staying connected with patients and being present requires constant attention, says UPenn internist Karen Bowles.
It's definitely something that you have to do with intention.
Bowles says as you're listening to a patient, you can feel yourself being pulled into different directions, remembering calls you have to return, prescriptions that need to be filled. Maybe you're thinking about your last patient. One day this happened, and then she heard this.
Dr. Bowles, are you looking in the chart of another patient while I am talking to you? And I had to say yes.
And then what?
She appropriately said that she felt that that was not professional and that she didn't appreciate it. And I told her that I was sorry.
Bowles started mindfulness meditation over 10 years ago. It's the practice of being present in the moment, noticing your thoughts and guiding your attention back to what's happening right now. Bowles says it helps her truly be with patients.
So I might notice a thought that says, I'm not getting this, or I'm annoyed. And then my intention is to just actually let it go and then see if I can use eye contact, use my sense of my own body and their body language to come back and notice what's right in front of me. There's more of a sense of really trying to notice that moment when my mind steps away and making a conscious attempt over and over again to come right back.
Bowles now teaches mindfulness to other healthcare providers at the Penn Program for Mindfulness.
Now, some people believe that empathy is a myth.
At Jefferson University Hospital, Dr. Mohammad Reza Hojat is explaining empathy to third-year med students, and he's showing them movie clips. Each scene contains a teaching moment on empathy.
The terminal in 1217.
Terminal? What terminal? Bus terminal?
The dying patient in 1217.
A bit of background. Hojat is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Jefferson, a psychologist, and he's one of the leading researchers on the topic of empathy. His interest in human relationships drew him to this issue, but he studies it like a scientist.
You have to provide some tangible evidence that there is a relationship between X and Y.
Hojat developed the Jefferson Scale of Empathy, which measures and grades empathy in healthcare providers and med students through a series of questions. It's used all over the world and has been translated into 45 languages. Hojat says the scale has allowed his team to quantify the impact of empathy, for example, showing that diabetic patients cared for by empathic doctors are healthier. Hojat also used his scale to track empathy levels in med students over time.
Empathy of our medical students declines as students progress through medical school. And this erosion of empathy we observe is more significant in the third year of medical school, when the curriculum shifts toward patient care and when empathy is most needed.
What's your thinking? Why does empathy decline?
There are several reasons for that. First of all, I think the emphasis is mostly placed on teaching the science of medicine, which is fine. But there is a benign neglect in teaching the art of medicine.
Hojat says if empathy can go down, it can also go up.
And we have shown in our studies that we can improve a student's empathy and resident's empathy by exposing them to targeted educational programs.
For example, if we show selected video clips from movies and discussing these video clips could enhance their understanding of patient's problem.
More than just saying, wow, that physician acted like a jerk, but analyzing, well, why was it acting like a jerk? You know, what about his behavior was offensive to us?
That's fourth-year medical student Jesse Edwards, who has attended Hojad's lecture.
Unfortunately, I think during the first and second year of medical school, all of our time, day and night, is focused on understanding diseases, understanding pathology, understanding how to treat diseases. And so the focus on patient care and understanding the patient is kind of lost in the first and second year.
Hojad says the interventions work, but there's a catch.
And the catch is that after 1 or 2 hours of exposing students to this program, or we call it workshop, you can see the increase in empathy score, which is great. But when we followed up these students 2 or 3 months later, the enhanced empathy scores went back to the original. So you have to reinforce it. You have to do more of it, probably exposing students every week, every month to some of these targeted programs in order to make it more sustained.
Let's hear about another approach aimed at teaching empathy to medical students. This one sets up a close, long-term relationship between med students and patients. Alana Gordon has this story.
Medical school, especially that first year, is packed with chemistry, biology, exams, and more exams. But at the University of Pennsylvania and a handful of other schools, students have another assignment, checking in with a patient living with a chronic disease during the first 2 years of med school. Dr. Horace DeLisser oversees Penn's program. It's over 10 years old, and it's mandatory for all students.
That first year and a half is a time when the students are, I think, most open to some of the lessons that this kind of experience could teach.
DeLisser says if they can learn early on to understand that each patient comes with an experience and a story, the hope is that as doctors, they can do a better job providing care that's meaningful. So the program matches students up with willing patients, and they must connect monthly, either in person or over the phone. DeLisser says the experience is more intimate than what some students are used to, but that's the point.
Even if in the beginning you're awkward and this kind of interaction feels uncomfortable, I think once you get into the relationship, particularly as the patients are giving to the students, I think a lot of that really dissipates. Plus, getting to know people is fun.
We got a piece of paper with your name on it, your address, your phone number, and a list of the doctor's appointments you have and some of the medical problems you have. That's all the information we had on you.
Amelia Breyer was matched with Linda Hines-Gordon. They first met in the waiting room of Hines-Gordon's doctor's office in 2012.
We got to talking, and I told her how my day went, how my day goes.
I mean, and to be candid, waiting 2 hours for an appointment that isn't yours, it's kind of a little, it's extra frustrating.
I was ready to go home.
Hines-Gordon is 50 years old. She's tall, slender, and smiles a lot. She has a congenital heart defect, diabetes, and intellectual disability. Breyer is 28 and now in year 2 of medical school. She's short next to Hines-Gordon.
Do you know much about the heart condition that you had when you were younger?
No, because I was small. I was little. I was real little. The doctor said I had 50-50 chance to survive.
About 90 patients with a range of chronic diseases and backgrounds volunteer to participate in this program each year. A lot of them, like Hines-Gordon, like the idea of sharing their experiences, maybe even helping to shape future doctors. Breyer admits some of the assignments, having to write essays, brought added stress for students amid other studies and exams. But she says she learned a lot by going to Hines-Gordon's home.
Patio, that this is where you'll notice the smell of smoke when she opens up the door. Linda doesn't smoke, but turns out her husband does. Something I wouldn't have known about her otherwise.
How you doing?
Oh, how you doing?
Yeah, good, good.
Okay.
You know
what?
And how's your family doing?
Doing fine. I talked to my dad. I went to see my dad earlier today.
Heinz Gordon goes over her medication regimen. This is all new to Breyer.
Oh, here they are, yeah.
This is the PM. This is the 4 o'clock. Mm-hmm.
You don't see yourself as sick?
No, I don't.
Breyer and Heinz Gordon recently completed the year-and-a-half-long program. Breyer says she's just beginning to process the experience, and she's struggling a bit to figure out how this will help her in the clinical setting.
I think it's still a little too kind of early for me to digest it all. Day one of medical school, you don't know anything, and you don't really know what you're supposed to be doing exactly, what your role is. So I think it was difficult to understand as a student what we were supposed to get out of this.
Delisser, who runs the program, says give it time. It may take months, even years, to realize the benefits.
I think you'll be a good doctor. And I have confidence in you that you'll do a good job.
Well, thanks. That really means like a lot to me. I really appreciate that.
I hope I see you again.
I hope so, too.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Coming up, a doctor who is living on the edge.
So I'm going to pack them up and send them with them. And I'm going to tell them how to carry them. Because if you put them in the middle of the suitcase, they can look like a bomb.
We'll meet a cardiologist who rescues medical devices from being buried alive. Stay tuned to The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. What's this strange noise? It's been altered to be audible to us humans and thus caught the attention of regular Pulse contributor Dr. Bethany Brookshire, also known as PsyCurious. She is an especially keen eye and ear for the strangest scientific findings. She's a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public, and she's here to tell us more. Hi, Bethany.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Bethany, you recently discovered some fascinating information about how bats converse when having dinner.
Yes, bats have fascinating political conversations over dinner. They talk about Tolstoy and they have deep conversations on the subject of, you know, the Ukraine. No, actually, unfortunately, while bats do have very interesting conversation over dinner, that conversation basically boils down to stand back, that bug is mine.
So what did we know previously about how bats talk to each other?
Well, it's actually very interesting because this particular species is the big brown bat. They are ubiquitous across North America. If you've ever had a bat in your house, this is the bat that you've had in your house. They're about the size of a fun-sized Snickers. They maybe weigh a little bit less. But these bats have been intensely studied for their echolocation. They're one of the biggest species that we study for how bats echolocate. But they were making all these other sounds, and no one had ever really studied them. people would go out and they would record bats making noise at night, and they would hear these other sounds being made, and they recognized at least six different types of calls that bats were making. But they had no idea what they were for. They couldn't trace them to a particular bat. They couldn't, because it was dark, they couldn't really see what the bats were doing when they made those calls. And so it was very difficult to determine exactly what the calls were for.
So what did they do?
So these bats had to be tested in captivity. So they took some bats and they flew them in pairs in this large room with a single captive mealworm trapped helplessly on the floor. And in this intensely competitive situation, they heard these two bats making social calls. So both of the bats would start calling and competing for the bait, the poor little mealworm. And they'd make these three or four chirps and then this buzz noise. And there's actually a YouTube video that was recorded with the paper where you can actually hear this brought down into the range of human hearing. And they found that the loudest and most frequent caller got the mealworm in the end.
But we can't, as humans, we can't hear this bat conversation going on.
No, in a sense, it's been over our heads this whole time. It's a very high-pitched sound. It's just at the edge of human hearing. So it's possible that, for example, young people might be able to hear it.
Bethany, you also got very interested in some new information on naked mole rats recently.
Yes, naked mole rats are amazing. First of all, they are what we call eusocial. That's spelled E-U-social. And eusocial means they're like bees. So they have a queen, and then they have the rest of the colony. They have a couple of males that are, you know, used for breeding. And then they have female workers, and the female workers are infertile. Their job is to dig and gather tubers, and the female does all of the breeding in the colony. So what they were interested in finding out is how these females produce milk.
The queens, right?
The queens, yes, the queens. So because the queens are in charge of this whole colony, they actually produce very large litters. The average is 12 pups at a time, every time they have a litter, which is a lot. And they hypothesized that if they were feeding 12 pups at a time for up to a month, presumably they would be producing this really high quality milk, very fatty, proteinaceous, rich milk, so that they wouldn't have to produce very much of it. It turns out, actually, that naked mole rats produce pretty average milk. It's not really any fattier or proteinaceous than other rodent milk. And so to support these massive litters, they produce half their body weight in milk every day while they nurse. It's huge.
And their worker mole rats keep them fed while they do this?
Yes, the worker mole rats do not produce any milk themselves. Their only job is to feed the queen, and also, you know, they're the nannies. She's got help.
Is this the only mammal that lives like an insect tribe of sorts?
As far as I know, I think there are two species, but they're the only mammals that live like bees, basically.
Yeah. And how long does a queen mole rat typically live?
She'll breed for 30 years.
What?
Yes.
So 24 mole rat babies a year for about 30 years?
Yes. I mean, she's maintaining a colony of about 140 workers here. So, you know, you got to keep them coming.
Yeah. And the whole time she produces this massive amount of milk.
Well, she only produces it for a month each time. So the young are only nursed for a month, and then they're on a tuber diet, just like the other naked mole rats.
Thank you so much, Bethany.
Thank you.
That's Bethany Brookshire of Science News. She writes for the educational blog Eureka Lab, and she tweets under the name SciCurious. It's time for our regular segment, So What Do You Do?, where we team up a layperson with a scientist for down-to-earth conversations about their work. In this edition, cartoon artist Brady Russell spoke with Youngmoo Kim, who researches music and entertainment technology at Drexel University. Russell asked Kim, so what do you do?
We do a little bit of everything in my lab. My lab's called the Music and Entertainment Technology Lab. I started it when I got to Drexel 7 years ago. And from that initial focus on music technology, which is still a really big part of what we do, we've expanded into lots of other areas, including robotics. My interest in robots is because robots are the interface of the computer to the physical world, right? Robots are really just computers with motors.
And you're doing robots as musical performers, right? That's cool. It made me think of the there's that 80s music video, but the big early jazz keyboardist guy,
Herbie Hancock, and the video for Rocket.
Yeah,
which is a great video. It's funny. I mean, robots are somewhat inherently cool, and I like to encourage that concept, encourage that notion as well. But also, I think that particularly humanoid robots, robots that look kind of like humans, you know, have two arms, two legs, and a head, can teach us a lot about what it means to be human. Not kind of in a Star Trek-y, well, maybe a little bit in a Star Trek-y way, but more in terms of when we're talking about, let's say, musical performance, we think of that's something that is uniquely human. But it's really hard to, let's say, measure a human musician. Humans aren't good at making really fine adjustments according to a scale, for example. So you can't ask a human performer, oh, play that chord again with 0.1 newtons more vertical force, right? That's absurd. I mean, I can play it louder, I can play it softer, but, you know. But with robots, you can. You can start to make very, very subtle variations. And in doing that, we hope that we can learn a little bit more about what it means to be musically expressive.
So you could do experiments where, like, you could do something where, like, you got someone to play something and somehow record it, and then you could have the robot do it exactly as that person did it, and then you could make tiny variations in how the robot did it in order to find out what gets people the emotional responses. That's a pretty dope bit of science there.
Yeah, again, that's the goal, really, to get a better understanding. Not to take the magic away. I mean, I think, you know, within art and performance and music, there's still a lot that you know, will always move us. But learning more about how we do that.
There was one last question that I was thinking of, which is what everyone always talks about with robots, and I could see people getting especially emotional about it when it comes to music. What do you say to folks when they're saying if robots really do become as good as everyone hopes they could be, then what will anyone else do? Like, it'll take everyone's work away. You must hear that.
I do. I hear it a lot. And I answer it a couple different ways. The easy one is that you should come to my lab and see how poor the robots are at doing anything, and you will be assuaged of any fears of a robot takeover. These things can basically, you know, can't even take two steps without falling over sometimes. I also say, I mean, I kind of use the historical precedent of, you know, the early astronomers like Galileo who were dissuaded from, you know, actually learning something about the universe, and that holds back progress.
Yeah, great to meet you. Peace out.
Thanks. It was great talking to you. Thanks for all the great questions.
Yeah.
Young-Woo Kim researches music and entertainment technology at Drexel University. He spoke with cartoon artist Brady Russell. And if you want to be part of our So What Do You Do segment, please email us at thepulse@whyy.org. You're listening to The Pulse. Our next story involves the following. A valuable life-saving resource being wasted. A doctor who witnessed suffering in his home country. A backroom rescue mission. What do you think? A model for resourcefulness or a recipe for disaster? Pulse contributor Avir Mitra has this story.
It's not every day that I discuss the best way to evade customs, but today that's exactly what I'm doing.
So I'm going to pack them up and send them to them. And I'm going to tell them how to carry them. Because if you put them in the middle of the suitcase, they can look like a bomb because they're closed circuit. So
how do you get them?
Or you just put them on the side because on the side you cannot see them.
Okay, well, I should clarify. We're not talking about bombs or drugs. We're talking about pacemakers. I'm speaking to a cardiologist, and believe it or not, we're talking about saving lives. Let's take a step back.
Well, what is a pacemaker? A pacemaker is a nice computerized device that goes under the skin, just below the breastbone on the left side, and is hooked up with two wires to the heart.
This is Dr. Daniel Mascarenhas, a cardiologist practicing in Easton, Pennsylvania, and today we're talking about pacemakers. Pacemakers are small devices that kind of look like metallic peppermint patties, and they have one job, and that's to keep a failing heart beating. Every year, about 250,000 people receive pacemakers in the United States. But our guest is originally from India, and over there, that number is much smaller, somewhere closer to 15,000. So what happens to all the people in India that aren't getting pacemakers?
In India, really, there is no safety net. So if you don't have the money, in short, if you're from the slum, you're dead.
You need a lot of money, too, because a pacemaker costs $6,000. And if you need a defibrillator, that costs $28,000. The fact that these life-saving devices are out of reach for many Indians isn't a surprise for Dr. Mascarenhas. After all, he grew up and trained there. But there was something about the pacemaker industry here in the United States that did surprise him.
One of my patients who had a pacemaker, and she died, they called me that she had died, and I was a little upset. They put in a pacemaker. 2 days later, she was dead, and they buried her with the pacemaker. That was an eye-opener for me that what a waste of resources. Something costing $6,000 was buried in the ground.
Pacemakers come with a 10-year battery life, give or take. But the question most of us never thought to ask is this. What happens to the pacemaker when the patient dies? Well, it turns out that the device is buried with the patient, still fully functional, still ticking away, trying to beat a dead heart in a dead body. And this could go on for years after the body is decomposed. It's kind of morbid.
The sad part is that we could reuse them in this country by resterilizing them, but nobody wants to do this because we are a land where we learn to waste.
So Dr. Mascarenhas put two and two together and came up with a scheme.
What do I do is, one is I call up the funeral homes. So every week when I have nothing better to do, instead of golfing, I call up the funeral homes, find out if they have devices.
If they do, he asks permission from the family to remove the device from the body.
I take them home, I put them in a Cydex solution, and I clean them up.
Then he measures the remaining battery life on the device, in hopes that there will be at least 5 years left on it.
And then once I do that, I put them in a packaging and send them to India.
But he can't just put them in the mail, because they could get stolen along the way, or they could end up in the hands of customs.
So anybody who tells me that they're going to Mumbai, I stop them and ask them, can you carry this for me? This doctor comes and picks them up. They get completely gas sterilized prior to using them. So if I've used it in a patient who can't afford it and who has still 5 years left to go on that battery, he can start planning for the future. I have had it all well thought out.
There's just one catch. This whole thing isn't exactly legal.
The FDA regulations are single use only.
Technically, this is illegal. Am I right about that?
Illegal if I use it in this country.
Why is it illegal in this country to reuse these expensive electronic devices? I mean, people buy refurbished laptops. People buy refurbished iPhones. Why can't you have a refurbished medical device?
If you put your refurbished iPhone in your body, then that won't be legal. Simple as that.
That's because even though Dr. Mascarenhas follows the sterilization process to the letter, the FDA can't guarantee sterility once the device has left the factory. And an implanted device that gets infected can be catastrophic for a patient. In India, the laws surrounding this are a little bit looser. That is to say, it is technically illegal to reuse devices, but so far enforcement seems to be low.
We get a consent from the patient that there is a small chance of infection. That's not the end of it. After the device is obtained, they need to send me a letter that they got this device free.
Over the years, Dr. Mascarenhas' project has steadily grown.
It's not only with devices. Now I've graduated from cardiac to gastrointestinal endoscopic surgery, to laparoscopic surgery, to orthopedics, wherein I collect devices which normally would have been thrown away because their shelf life has expired, but really they have not expired. And we've used them in India because one man's trash is another man's gold.
So that's the position Dr. Mascarenhas finds himself in. To do something that seems so common sense, He has to essentially become a grave robber, then a smuggler, and only then a doctor.
And believe me, it's not always a rosy picture. This was in January of 2003, wherein, by mistake, I went to the wrong area in the customs and they imported my bag. And they took all the devices.
But for Dr. Mascarenhas, it's worth it.
I could find a diamond worth $5,000, but that wouldn't stimulate me as much as finding a device which has 10 years. Well, a diamond's not going to give somebody life.
For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra.
Keeps me searching for a heart of gold.
We checked in with medical ethicist Art Kaplan on this issue. He says he's generally not opposed to reusing medical devices, but it's not a good idea when done in this kind of mom-and-pop type operation. Too many things could be going wrong in the sterilization process. The medical device could be compromised in some way the doctor is not aware of. True patient consent in India cannot really be verified. So Kaplan says the reuse of medical devices requires strict guidelines and rules. We'll post some research on this issue on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Monday marked the deadline to enroll in health care coverage through the Affordable Care Act this year. Federal officials say over 7 million people signed up in total, and of course, plenty of them waited till the last minute. Congreso, a Latino service agency in Philadelphia, was packed Monday with those seeking help with the application.
There certainly has been a last-minute rush, and actually, what you see right now, it's half what was here earlier this morning.
Jose Rivera with Congreso says he's excited they've been able to connect with so many people, even though Latino enrollment nationwide appears to be low. Also, with a flood of visitors to healthcare.gov in the last day, the site jammed up and many couldn't get through. That was unsettling for 26-year-old Jocelyn Otero.
Estoy frustrada porque no, hasta ahora no podemos hacer nada.
Otero is a home aide. She took the day off from work, but she was told she'd need to follow up because of the delays. Federal officials anticipated last-minute snags, and they are letting people who have started the process complete their enrollment within 2 weeks, and there are other exceptions as well. People who are uninsured and missed out will have to wait till November to enroll and may face fines in the meantime. Next week on The Pulse, we're going to check in with some people who tried to navigate new coverage options early on, and we'll find out what happened with them. And of course, we'd love to hear from you and your healthcare experience. Please email us at thepulse@whyy.org. Coming up, a conversation about wolf whistles, catcalls from strangers.
I developed early. I developed around 11 or 12, you know, and I had like grown men like addressing me as if I was a woman. It felt extremely uncomfortable, felt awkward, it felt really ugly for me.
That's next on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott.
Mommy! Mommy! Hey, Mommy! Hey, Ma, can I walk with you?
There's a national conversation on the issue of street harassment that happens each year during the first week of April. Tanya English is here. Hi, Tanya.
Hey, Mike.
You've been tracking this issue for some time.
Depending on where you live or how you get to work, maybe it's been a while since anyone yelled, "Yo, shorty," at you from across the street. When call-outs and come-ons like that turn aggressive, Holly Curl says that's street harassment.
women who have to hear that a lot, it just gets annoying.
Crow began as a blogger and later founded a nonprofit group to help women feel safe in public spaces.
That's something that, you know, men are afforded is the luxury of walking places without other people approaching them and commenting on how they look or telling them to smile or asking for their phone number.
Teenage girls in particular struggle with come-ons that escalate to questions like, where are you going, or can I come with you? That can feel threatening, even if a man doesn't intend to take those questions any further. Policy ideas to stop street harassment have evolved, but early on, one solution was to simply separate men and women. In 1906, the Women's Municipal League in New York City proposed a ladies-only commuter train to protect women from the fearful crushes of licentious men. Now, supporters of that plan were called men haters, and the opponents wrote lots of editorials in local magazines and newspapers.
I don't think our New York men are such beasts that we can't sit in the same car with them. I like men. Mrs. Lily Devereaux Blake.
Today's anti-street harassment activists are sometimes also dubbed men haters. But Holly Curl says she considers men allies in her work. She wants to create a common definition for street harassment, but she's up against some pervasive and conflicting ideas about what behavior is acceptable. Take Saturday morning cartoons, for example. Remember Pepe Le Pew?
The skunk would chase that cat around, and she was always trying to get away from him.
Golden girl, you are the corned beef to me. I am the cabbage to you.
And it's like, oh, ha, ha, ha. Like, that's funny, but no, I mean, she wants to get away from him. That shouldn't be a joke. She should be able to get away from him.
Anti-street harassment doesn't mean men and women can't speak to each other outside. But Curl's advice to men who want to connect with women is, compliment a woman's ability, not her appearance.
So, for example, as a runner, you know, men have said things like, I like the way your tits bounce when you run. That's not a compliment. That's really offensive. That was so upsetting and humiliating. On the other side, I've had some men and women say things like, oh, you go, girl, or your stride looks really strong. I take that as a compliment.
Curl also suggests that men reserve their compliments for the women in their lives who they actually know. A stranger may or may not consider your clever come-on flattering.
Tanya, I get it, but is there any evidence, any research that this is a public health problem?
You know, I think that's still an open question. When you search health research databases, what you look for is the term stranger harassment. That replaces street harassment. And there aren't very many studies on that. And there aren't even a lot of mentions of that term. But that may be changing. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently added a question to one of its national surveys about stranger harassment. Cornell University researcher Beth Livingston says that may encourage public health professionals to consider this a topic for research. Now, she usually studies gender issues in the workplace, but recently she began working with an anti-street harassment group to review stories from women who've experienced this. And Livingston says she's noted some really big emotional red flags.
There was a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, a lot of people who described changing their behaviors and losing sleep at night because they knew they were going to have to walk by the same people every day on their way to work, on their way to school.
So this really affects women's lives.
Yeah, Livingston says many women describe lewd encounters with adult men starting when they were as young as 12 or 13 years old. Often these were not one-off stories, but frequent encounters. And she says over time, those kind of encounters have the potential to be more destructive than, say, something like bullying, which happens at school. She says for some women, street harassment is a stress that can accumulate.
In the same way that having a sick child or family member for a long period of time can wear on you and build up stress, and your own health is then put at risk.
So, Mike, and lots of national groups are trying to document the problem and using social media to really give women a way to respond in a safe way. Others are talking directly to men about what's acceptable. I spoke with muralist and public artist Tatiana Fazale-Zadeh. She created a series of posters with captions with things like, critiques on my body are not welcome. Her street art series is called Stop Telling Women to Smile.
Having a man tell me that I would be prettier if I would smile or ask me to give him a smile makes me feel like I'm outside to entertain him. And that's the thing about it. It like happens so often and so frequently. It becomes an issue and you feel uncomfortable and you feel violated. It's called Stop Telling Women to Smile, and it consists of portrait drawings of women that I know. These very, really pretty, sketchy portraits of women. Most of the women are women of color. You know, I feel like they're faces that women would have as they're outside on the street, bold and kind of strong and neutral faces. And I'm pasting them up wherever I can, Philly and New York. I've been to D.C. It's anti-street harassment. So if you're a man who doesn't commit street harassment, then this has nothing to do with you. If you're a woman who enjoys, you know, this type of interaction between men and women outside, then I guess this isn't for you either.
Local activists in Philadelphia are planning to poster the city with this artwork this week, along with other slogans about anti-street harassment.
And Tanya, we're going to post some photos of this Stop Telling Women to Smile series on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. What does math have to do with fish? A Princeton professor who just won the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement is a mathematician by training, but devotes his skills to understanding ecosystems. The Tyler Prize, by the way, is a big deal in environmental circles. So he told us about his work in his own words, and to get the conversation going, we did our usual drill. We asked him to state his name, his title, and what he had for lunch.
Simon Levin. I'm the Georgia Moffitt Professor of biology at Princeton University, and I just finished off a serving of sushi. My research is about ecological systems, how they're structured, how they function, and particularly how we can protect them and the services they provide us. I went to graduate school in mathematics because it was a tool that I knew I could use, and it was the thing that came easiest to me and I did best. But even while I was in graduate school, I knew I wanted to apply mathematics to addressing problems of the world, and in particular biological problems. And so I began working on physiological problems, but within a few years had turned most of my attention to ecological problems. Mathematics is the way we make predictions and the way we are able to develop strategies for managing systems effectively. The ecosystems are highly interconnected networks. And so, for example, some of my work has been studying the marine ecosystems on the West Coast, where it's been known that the removal of top predators in the system can have cascading effects throughout the system. These are called keystone species or keystone predators. The most striking example is reflected in James Estes's work, where the removal of the sea otter caused cascading changes throughout the system. So in the absence of the sea otter, as you probably know, was hunted out over most of the west coast of the United States, and only recently, since it was protected, has begun to come back. When the removal of the sea otter allowed the abalone populations to increase, allowed the urchin populations to increase. The urchin populations feed on kelp, and so as they built up, the kelp populations were driven down. When the kelp populations were driven down, the nutrients near shore went down, and the shore became less buffered. That was bad for fish populations, but good for the shellfish that the sea otters were no longer eating. And so the system shifted from a fin fishery to a shell fishery with dramatic economic consequences for the system. I was involved early on with trying to understand the effect of power plants on the Hudson River and commented on and built models to deal with the striped bass populations. That work eventually contributed to the agreements in getting a resolution to issues that were associated with the building of power plants on the Hudson, and most recently, together with a postdoctoral fellow, Guy Ziv, a study looking at the consequences of new dams in the Mekong Delta and what their effects would be on migratory fish populations. But I regard my greatest contributions to be not in these individual case studies, which I think help to illustrate the power of quantitative methods, but rather a changing attitude in fisheries towards managing systems as large marine ecosystems, taking into account the interactions among species and the effects on the biogeochemistry of the oceans. And so a lot of our work now is directed towards trying to model the dynamics of marine ecosystems. In the last 20 years, increasingly, I have turned my attention to the interface between ecology and related environmental sciences on the one hand and economics, because I'm convinced that one can't solve the environmental problems just doing biology, just doing physics and chemistry. One has to understand these systems as coupled with the human systems that create stresses, that withdraw resources, that add pollutants to the system, that change the climate. So I've been concerned with understanding human behavior, understanding the linkage between ecological and economic systems, how to get across to managers and to people more broadly the value of natural systems, and ultimately to understand how we can get cooperation. There are many examples of cooperation in nature. There are also examples of how, for example, small fisheries have engaged in cooperative agreements that help to manage it. Our greatest challenge now is to extend those cooperative arrangements to much broader scales to deal with global problems like climate change, like biodiversity loss. Much of my work research now is directed towards trying to structure and understand agreements on these pressing environmental problems.
Simon Levin is professor of biology at Princeton University. His work just won the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Zach Seward. And Zach, congratulations to you and your wife on the birth of your son, Alonzo. Laura Benchoff is our intern. Charlie Kyer, our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. And we got two really great ideas that we started to work on from listeners this week. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.